go ahead and start. I'm curious.
Okay.
I'm curious what you said that there were many letters. How did the controversy with Olivia Records begin? How did it come out?
The first thing we knew about there being a controversy was a letter from Janice Raymond. She sent us an envelope containing a draft chapter of her book, The Transsexual Empire. And she had included everything except mentioning me by name. It went over in some detail. Well, she included some of the work that she had purportedly done on the topic of transgender, which at the time she called transsexuality. I don't think that at that point the distinction was existed in any meaningful way from an intellectual academic perspective. She was writing as an academic who was writing a book, and the book was about transgender and about, I'm trying to put myself in that headspace from that time and refer to it as transsexuality, which is pretty much what she did. She was talking about the deleterious effect of transsexuals on women and women's space and women's businesses in general, and she talked about Olivia Records in a kind of a generalized way without ever mentioning me. It seemed clear in retrospect that she was trying to out me. Now, we chuckled over that because I had never been in. I had never kept my identity private at Olivia Records. When Olivia Records had first contacted me in, I don't remember the exact year, I think it was 94, when they first contacted me, one of the very first things I said to them is, well, I want you to know I'm a transsexual, using the old terms. And just so we're very clear with each other going in. And the three women who originally contacted me, who I believe were Judy Dlugacz, Linda Tillery, and I can't remember who the third person was, said, well, that's okay. That's fine. We don't care. You're one of us as far as we're concerned. And on that basis, we proceeded on a long, long process of mutually getting to know each other before we did anything serious with each other in terms of work. So that by the time the letter from Janice Raymond arrived, sometime down the road, several years, I don't remember how long, the idea that this letter was outing me was ridiculous. So we read it with the idea in mind that here was a person who didn't have very much idea about what was going on with us, who was writing a book about transsexuality from what was clearly a biased position. And we passed her letter and the draft of the chapter around at the collective, as we did with any mail that came in. We passed it around to everyone at the collective, gave everyone a chance to read and comment on it. And the way we did that was, well, there are actually several ways. One of them was you could actually write on the manuscript if you wanted to, or you could attach post-it notes or whatever. And it made the rounds. It usually takes days, because at that time I think there were 12 or 13 women in the collective, not all of whom were there at any one time. It takes time for such a letter to circulate. So it circulated, and it came back, and we reviewed it, I think, at a meeting. And in general, what people wrote on it was, well, this is weird. I don't understand what she's talking about. She's certainly deeply prejudiced or bigoted. Why is she coming out against transies? And then there was a side discussion about it, and Ginny Burson wrote, if we're going to go down the road that she is suggesting, she being Janice Raymond, why don't people like her just admit that the goal is the ovens and be done with it? I wrote, in my turn to comment, I wrote, we need a book on the topic of transsexuality and feminism, but this is not that book. End of quote. That was all I said. That was the sum and substance of that. And we put, because Raymond had asked for comment, we made copies of what she had sent us, and we sent them back to her. These are, you know, 8x10 letter size sheets. We got an 8x10 manila envelope of the kind that we used for such correspondence, and we sent it back to her with a cover letter, I think, saying, enclosed are the comments that you requested. Thank you for your letter and for this interesting article, you know, something like that. And that was all we heard about it until the book came out. And of course, when the book came out, it mentioned me by name, which she had not done in her little teaser to us. That was that sequence of things. Then we began getting what I would call hate mail from various people out there who identified themselves as variously lesbians and lesbian separatists. We kept tabs on them, and it was clear to us that they were coming from a fairly restricted group of people who were very angry and who we felt deserved to be heard. I mean, after all, you know, sisterhood counts for everybody, even the people who send you hate mail. So we attempted to engage them in dialogue. And then, and I'm speaking slowly, by the way, because I'm concerned that your recording may be as hard to hear as it is for me to hear you, because when you talk, you're barely audible to me. No, so, I mean, otherwise I would be talking faster. I'm sorry?
You sound great.
Okay, all right. Well, then, maybe I can talk a little faster. I try to be as clear as I can on these things because frequently they can be requoted out of context, and I want to be sure that there aren't any misunderstandings about what I'm saying. We meaning the Olivia Collective, tried to engage anyone who wrote to us in dialogue. And when things began to appear in various places in the press, I mean, Off Our Backs is the first one that comes to mind. On the whole, there were a number of publications at that time which were running various letters about this. I no longer remember what they were, but we had them all either because we knew about them, because we were politically active in the field, or because other people would send them to us. And whatever they were, the collective, I'll say that again, the collective, speaking as a collective, would answer them, either in the press by sending a letter to the press under the name of the collective, or by sending individuals letters and asking them to engage us in dialogue in a more reasoned way. And we found after a while that that didn't work, that we were not dealing with something that we could deal with in a reasoned way. And this was a great surprise to the collective, because we felt that we were there for the purpose of making music and, to a certain extent, revolution, of changing the way women thought. And we felt that that would be done through a process of dialogue, through reasoned discourse. And we discovered, to our surprise, that it wasn't, that it was done through passion. In very irrational ways. And after a while, we scheduled a meeting in the San Francisco Bay Area. The collective at the time was located in the Wilshire District in Los Angeles. Because a lot of the hate mail was coming from the Bay Area, we decided to hold a kind of a town meeting there at which we could address this directly, because we felt that through mail it was getting totally out of control. We were now getting what many people in the collective were willing to call hate mail, which was to say stuff that was not open to reason. And we felt that we should address this directly in person. So we scheduled such a meeting. I don't remember now how it was scheduled, but we scheduled it somehow with the women's community in the Bay Area. And that was probably done through the contacts that the collective had, the contacts that the collective had with various women's organizations in the Bay Area.
Do you know approximately, like, when that was?
No, I don't. It was before 1977, before 1976, but that doesn't leave a very large window, because I started with the collective in 74, so I would say 76, 75, 76, probably 76, but I can't be sure of that at this point. Given a long time, I could probably dig up some corollary material that would nail the date down better, but I can't right now. I do remember that when we got there, we discovered that there was a large presence of women who were not from the Bay Area,
right,
who had been invited in, apparently, by separatists from Oakland, and who were actually from Chicago. And they came in and acted as if they had been brought in as sort of shock troops in order to attack us, which they proceeded to do. They attacked the collective and they attacked me. And I unfortunately walked right into it. I don't remember the exact words that were said, but a person got up, a woman got up, and made a fairly long speech, which was on the surface reasoned and dealt with the topic from a theory perspective and from a feminist discourse perspective, and went through it. And we realized after a minute or two that what she was saying was completely bizarre and didn't really have anything to do with either feminist theory or discourse of any kind. She was saying things like, of course, as we know, and then she would go on and in so many words say transsexualism is evil and destroys women's space and, you know, da-da-da-da-da. In other words, putting forth an extreme position of what I called in the post-transsexual manifesto, the appropriation of liberal language by a radical right wing. Although the word wing gets left out in a lot of reprintings of that. It was we sat there looking at each other and wondering where this was coming from and how this person could present it in this utterly slanted way and so calmly and attempt to present it as fact. And then I think the total of her remarks ran for under 5 minutes. I would say 4 to 5 minutes of this continual theory of hate speech in the guise of feminist theory. And I was, it turned into a direct attack on me. And I sat there going, holy crap, where is this coming from? How can she be saying this stuff? This is all bullshit. And she ended it by saying, and we'd like to hear what Sandy Stone has to say in response. And I said, in a kind of a querulous voice, but that's all bullshit. And that apparently was exactly what they wanted me to say. Because the next thing I knew, there were people standing on chairs, literally, and pointing at me and screaming that that's exactly what we need. Here's a man trying to break up women's space with his male speech. And that was, for all intents and purposes, the end of the meeting.
Wow.
All that could happen thereafter was people screaming at each other. Not me. I mean, having said that, I shut up and didn't say anything else. And the collective tried to restore order in the room. And there was no restoring of order. It was impossible. We wound up seeing Nancy Vogel, who was a musician at the time and who had worked with us as a side musician on several albums, denouncing me. I had engineered for her on several occasions. It was very ugly. I was shocked. It's a good British term. And that, I believe, was the only time that we attempted to open a public dialogue about it. After that, we retreated to the castle and pulled up the drawbridge. We tried to continue to engage through the press, you know, by means of letters in the press, but essentially circling the wagons was the only thing that we could do because there was no dialogue to be had. There was something going on that we did not understand and that we were not prepared for. And in terms of the idea of bringing in the equivalent of meeting busters from out of town, I mean, we had never dreamed of a strategy like that. And the idea that that we could walk into a meeting where I could be baited into doing something that could then be attacked, that was just, our jaws were hanging down. So that was not only the story of when we got the first, I guess I went further than you asked for and probably than I attended, but the progression from that first letter from Janice Raymond to a full-on meltdown in a public meeting was not, that was not a large space of time we were talking about. From there on, we were sort of at a loss as to what to do. We didn't have a strategy for being in a situation in which we were being hated on. So I'll stop there.
Well, what was your working relationship in the community after the controversy?
it didn't change.
Was it pretty consistent, or?
Yeah, there was, with regard to the community in which I worked, there was never any change. I got, for a while, people I didn't know would come up to me when we did public events, not public events for feminist theory dialogue, but musical events.
And right.
People would come up to me and offer support, you know, say how much they like my work or, you know, things of that sort, or we're glad you're doing good work with Olivia, we hope you carry it on, things of that sort. And I felt at the time that that was not strange, and that I felt that while there were people who undoubtedly hated on me, we now knew that, they were not likely to come up to me and say I hate you, so the fact that more people were coming up and offering support was probably reasonable. And I was grateful for it. I was happy for it. It was very encouraging. And then we had we heard from one of the women who produced our musical events that a separatist paramilitary group called the Gorgons, which was based, I think, in Oakland, but I'm not sure, was going to come to the next concert that we gave. And the Gorgons at the time were a group of women with a fearsome reputation. They dressed in paramilitary camo gear, and they shaved their heads. And they were reputed to carry live weapons, although I did not have personal verification of that. But they had said that they would come to our next concert armed and they would kill me.
Wow.
And because of all the hate speech that was around at that point, the collective felt that as a collective, we had to take that threat seriously. So the next concert we gave, we actually had security. It was, I'm trying to look for the right word. It was dismaying and humiliating that we actually felt we had to have security at a concert of women's music. I mean, come on. What women's music was about at the time was, let's all get together and fight the patriarchy. And all of a sudden, we, you know, through music, by bringing women together and uplifting them to the medium of music, let's raise our consciousnesses, let's see how we're oppressed, let's change our state by virtue of raising our own consciousnesses, but for God's sake, let's not fight with each other. So here we were, now we were perforce fighting with each other. We were having security at a concert of women's music, and we were not happy about it. Okay. There's some stuff I still don't feel I'm free to talk about, so I'll have to omit it. It's not relevant to this, but it came up for me in that moment because it was happening at about the same time. At any rate, we did the concert with the security. Some Gorgons came, or some women who shaved their heads and wore camo gear, came, but they didn't have weapons, and they didn't shoot me. And after that, we continued to do concerts. That's I guess that's, I hope that answers the question.
Well, it does. It does. What really, how I even, what piqued my interest was a letter in it was a West Coast feminist newspaper called Sister.
Okay.
And some people had written a letter, and there were people from all across the United States. There were people from St. Louis and people from, I believe, Chicago. One of those people is a familiar name, Lisa Vogel.
Oh, yes. Yes, how could we forget Lisa Vogel?
Yeah. Her attitude sure have changed. But it wasn't so much the letter that they sent that wowed me. What wowed me was the response. There was a response, and it says, Olivia replies. Recently, a leaflet has been circulated here concerning Olivia's relationship with Sandy Stone, who since the spring of 1976 has worked with Olivia as a recording engineer. Sandy is a transsexual, and Olivia is being criticized for not making that fact widely known immediately.
Okay, may I interrupt you for a moment?
Sure.
Is this the letter that contains the phrase, we intend to be rocking on the porch of the old Dykes home together?
No.
Okay.
No. But, I'm coming from the perspective of reading this as, in 1976, I was 9 years old.
Okay.
And thinking about that time as a child and thinking about I grew up in Indiana, but how kind of backwards things were.
Yeah.
And this response was beautiful. May I read it?
Yes, I absented myself from that, by the way, because I was the person who was being written about, so I didn't participate in the writing, but go ahead.
Sandy is a transsexual, and Olivia is being criticized for not making the fact widely known immediately on beginning to work with Sandy. It is further being said that we are ripping women off by calling ourselves a women's recording company while working with a transsexual engineer.
Mm-hmm.
In the following paragraphs, we would like to explain for those who may not know what a transsexual is, to recount our process in hiring Sandy Stone, to clarify our politics around working with Sandy, and to have and to answer specific criticisms that have been brought forward. A transsexual person who, from an early age, perhaps from birth, identifies as the opposite gender from her or his genetic sex. In the case of Sandy Stone, this means a person grew up outwardly as male who inwardly experienced being essentially female. In many cases, this includes a feminist identification, which, because of imposed stereotypes as well as the intolerable position of being female inside a male body, results in extremely painful life situation. For many women, evolving a consciousness of class and sex oppression involves uncertainty, anger, and the turmoil which accompanies any major life process. For transsexuals who are simultaneously evolving through confronting their true sexual identity, these processes are doubly difficult. Medical technology has recently provided for those with the means to afford it and the guts to withstand it, a way to surgically transform the genitals from those of birth to those of the opposite gender. Persons like Sandy, who have undergone sexual reassignment surgery, are technically known as male-to-female postoperative transsexuals and live lives no different from other women. However, although a great deal of attention is usually focused on the surgery itself, it is not generally understood that the process of sexual reassignment is long, grueling, and a painful one, requiring many years of hard work prior to surgery, and that this too well-publicized step is merely the confirmation of a process that has already gone to near completion by that time. The impression fostered by the media that sexual reassignment is a single operation simplifies and distorts an extremely complex and subtle process to the preoperative transsexual, to which the preoperative transsexual must address most of her life for years prior to genital reassignment. Sandy Stone was referred to us as an excellent woman engineer, perhaps even the goddess-sent engineer wizard we had so long sought. In our second meeting, when Sandy told us about her transsexuality, we had to reassess our commitment to her and hers to us. We did this, as we do everything at Olivia, collectively and from the point of view of our politics. In our first reaction to the situation, we had reservations. Should we validate a process, sex reassignment, that seemingly only the privileged have access to? Should we hire someone who had male privilege? Could we accept and trust Sandy as a woman? We reasoned that it requires some material means to undergo sexual reassignment process. A person does not gain privilege by doing it. Quite the contrary, a few very well-publicized transsexuals aside. Because Sandy decided to give up completely and permanently her male identity and live as a woman and a lesbian, she is now faced with the same kinds of oppression that other women and lesbians face. She must also cope with the ostracism that all of society imposes on a transsexual. In evaluating whom we will trust as a close ally, we take a person's history into consideration. But our focus as political lesbians is on what her actions are now. If she is a person who comes from privilege, has she renounced that which is oppressive in her privilege? And is she sharing with other women that which is useful? Is she sharing her own oppression, or is she aware of her own oppression? Is she open to struggle around class, race, and other aspects of lesbian feminine politics? These were our yardsticks in deciding whether to work with a woman who grew up with male privilege. We felt that Sandy met those same criteria that we apply to any woman with whom we plan to work closely. Because of our politics, and despite our initial feelings of strangeness around the situation, feelings which, alas, it seems many women must go through when confronted with a transsexual woman, we were able to begin working with Sandy. Our daily political and personal interactions with her have confirmed for each of us that she is a woman we can relate to with comfort and with trust. As to why we did not immediately bring this issue to the attention of the national women's community, we have to say that to us, Sandy Stone is a person, not an issue. Our judgment was that her transsexualism was a fact that might be a concern to any that might be a concern to any woman who would work closely with her, such as the women Olivia would record. We felt fine about telling those women because there was context for it, because we had to struggle. It's hard to read some of this. And because we had to struggle relationship with them. Beyond that, we saw no way to communicate the situation to the greater women's community without Sandy being objectified. And if Sandy were to become the focus of controversy, we felt that we needed a period of time in which to develop a foundation of mutual trust and support and a solid working relationship to help us understand that turmoil. We see transsexualism as a state of transition, and we feel to continue to define a person primarily by a condition is to stigmatize her at the expense of her growth process as a woman. One unfortunate consequence of this decision has been that we did not demystify to the community at large how Sandy was able to acquire her skills, and we regret this. Our hopes for sharing skills and providing women across to work are much closer to fulfillment because of, not in spite of, Sandy Stone. The women in our technical department are thrilled that Sandy has joined them. She has contributed to our group not only her many skills, but her vision of ways to share them that goes beyond what we were able to imagine. For example, besides training women in sound engineering, she will actually be building our recording studio and will be apprenticing other women in techniques of design and designing and building electronic equipment. She is also in the process of writing a book for women, which will be a step-by-step explanation of the recording process. Almost a year ago has passed since we started working with Sandy, during which she has been our colleague in hard work, struggle, wonderful accomplishments, and even finer plans. All of us are looking forward to the day when work can begin on our studio and Sandy can train other women. As we do each other, we ask that everything of Sandy, and she gives it. She has chosen to make her life with us, and we expect to grow old together, working and sharing. Women.
Oh, that's right. That's the clean version. Okay. The original version that, as it was written, was, and we expect to wind up rocking on the porch of the old lesbian's home together. I think they felt that was a little too extreme.
But I think, given the state of the divisiveness of radical feminism towards a lot of radical feminism towards trans women.
Yeah.
This was a breath of fresh air. I mean, and to realize that this was in the way. I mean, like I said, I was 9 years old when this was going on. That during that time, such a progressive view of transsexuals was there. I mean, this is one of the most articulate, for something that's this old, it's so on point about, for many of us, the experience of growing
well,
up trans. I mean, there are
then as now, the very narrow-minded people, the extremely conservative people who do all the hating, are the ones who make all the noise. it's nothing different now. Far more people then were favorably disposed toward what we were doing than were not. But the people who were more favorably disposed were not, you know, were not running around shouting it. The people who were doing the hating were running around shouting it, and they always do. That's just the way, apparently, the world is designed.
Well, one thing from the letter, this group of people signed on to this open letter to Olivia. One of the paragraphs that really kind of caught me was, they said the decision to work with a transsexual is one issue in itself, but the omission of this information from the public of women who support you is an unwise choice. We feel that it's deceptive not to share this process with the women's community. Many women give you their financial support precisely because they trust you to work with women exclusively, and you are not being accountable to these women. There's an assumption in there that A, you're not a woman, and B, that Olivia Records was being deceptive, and in turn, you were being deceptive. And,
mm-hmm.
and that's such a common narrative in many realms.
Yeah.
Trans women as deceivers. And it's as inspired as I was by the response, this kind of attack, it bothered me because it's essentially the same attack that's going on today. You know,
yeah, the difference today being that now we as transies have a voice. And we can speak back from a position of power. And that's the only thing that's changed, as far as I'm concerned. Hate is always with us. It always will be. The ignorance will always be with us. People are always going to be afraid of things they don't know or understand. And there's always going to be a fairly large number of people who want the world to be very small and very explainable and in their terms and not want it to change and not want anything that rocks their boat to appear. And if it does, they will react very, very badly. And there's nothing new about that. That's the way human beings are. It's always been that way. I think it always will be that way.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Difference is... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
The difference is that we have more ways to speak back to that now. And I think also we have more of an understanding of how hate works. I think more of us understand now that you can't engage hate with reason. Even when hate presents itself in the guise of reason, if you try to reason back, you're wasting your time. What you need is to build your power base. And that's, if there's anything we've learned, I think it's that. Organizations like Lambda Legal, like the various transgender support organizations that didn't exist, the Transgender Law Project, all of those things are ways of being able to take space, which is rightfully ours, and be able to speak back. And I think that's the best that we can hope for in an imperfect world. We're never going to rid the world of hate. We're never going to educate people who don't want to be educated. No matter how much of theory they may appropriate, no matter how much they may try to appear reasonable and rational, they can't be educated. And we shouldn't even be trying. I mean, we can try with people who actually want to engage in dialogue, but we shouldn't waste our energy on people who don't. Life is too short. Why do that? Concentrate on what you can do.
Well, I'm curious, since you've said that, have you had any of the people that that were against you then come forward and express a change of heart or kind of a mea culpa moment?
Yes, I have. And by the way, Lisa Vogel and Nancy Vogel are two different people. The musician we were working with was Nancy Vogel. Lisa Vogel is a different person.
Sure. I think anybody that knows anything about the Michigan Women's Music Festival and Camp Trans and...
Right, knows who Lisa Vogel is.
Okay.
Yes. And that the experience of meeting someone who was an anti-transy in the 70s, meeting them now, and having them recall their behavior as being limited in its understanding of the issues, and having them express some contrition for having done that. This continues occasionally right up to the present day. It gets rarer with time, that's understandable, but yes, I have experienced that.
Ethan, do you know Ethan St. Pierre? Are you familiar?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Are you familiar with Ethan St. Pierre?
I'm not sure I can hear the name clearly. It sounds familiar.
Yeah. Well, Ethan is my co-host.
Ah, now you're much louder.
Yeah, Ethan is my co-host, Ethan St. Pierre.
Okay.
And we talk pretty often about really the late 70s, early 80s. We talk about it a lot because if you look at shows like WKRP in Cincinnati, which one of their first shows, Herb Tarlick, was going after Lonnie Anderson and Johnny Fever told her that she used to be a man.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, at the end of the episode, basically Herb says, "I don't care," you know? And it was like a sweet moment. And my thinking back is like, you know, we're getting more and more progressive as the years go by, but that's not really the case. I mean, I can point to, you know, different things in society and things like this, where it seems like things were a lot more fluid and open then, as opposed to as progressive as I thought. In some ways it's better, but in a lot of ways it's a lot harder, I think.
I agree. Yep.
But how do you view that time now? I mean, I'm sure that there were a lot of highly charged emotions back then, but how do you how do you think of that time now?
Mixed. It was a time of great turmoil for me, for many reasons, not just the hate mail, the thing with Olivia, but there was a lot going on. I mean, the entire universe did not consist of Olivia Records. I was having some heavy adventures that affected me very deeply and changed my life, and continue to affect me down to this day. So in terms of the Olivia business, if we can call it that, I remember it in a complex way. I love and care for those women dearly. We had a very close relationship. It was a true collective. A lot of us lived in the collective house. And eventually, of course, it got so large that we had to rent the house next door and then one across the street. We were fairly large and close. And until it got too unwieldy to do it, we even ate all our meals together. That's an experience that I consider to be rare and precious. And I'm thrilled that I had it. But I wish more people could. I don't think...
Me too.
The part that got ugly, life is ugly sometimes, particularly if you stick your head up in any way, if you make yourself visible, which unfortunately happened with me. It can make life very interesting. Those were interesting times in the Chinese sense. I don't regret them for a second. I learned a lot. One of the things I learned is how hate works. And I think I've saved myself a tremendous amount of time and energy later by understanding that you can't reason with people who hate. You have to find other ways of dealing with hatred. That has saved me a tremendous amount of energy.
I it's the oddest thing because the last 3 years of my life have taught me that. And especially I've come at it from more of a political perspective. And when I say political, I mean, like inside the DNC type of stuff. But seeing how other people's really irrational, I don't even know if it's hate, but movement against you, really the only thing that you can, I mean, you could spend all day fighting back against it, or you can work around it and keep doing what you're doing. And, for the longest time, I felt like every day was a battle, it was like jumping into a ring, and now I don't feel that way at all. I feel if there's a roadblock, it's finding a way around that roadblock.
Yeah, or changing the terms of engagement.
Sure.
That's an old guerrilla tactic that I actually learned from Cindy, which is if you're outnumbered and they're coming at you, what you do is change the terms of engagement.
Worked in the Revolutionary War.
It worked in the Revolutionary War. It's worked for the Afghanistanis, of all the people that come to mind, for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And it works for transies, too. You don't have to agree to the way in which people want to attack you. You can step aside.
Well, and I think as our community grows and that's what's so funny is because I feel like I'm inside the community now and I'm growing with the community, whereas then I look back and I see all the history that you've had in the community even before I was like, where I was saying, I don't understand who I am. You know, I know, I mean, back then, I didn't know I was trans. I just knew that I was different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know how that manifested itself. I couldn't put the words in because I wasn't allowed to as a child. You know, I wasn't, you were this, and you couldn't be this. And that was just the way it was, so. But to think and just to hear other people's histories, that's why I think this is so vital for people to understand and see and to experience some of that through your story and understand what you're saying, because it's important. It's important.